Hello. In episode 11 of series 3 of Airs for Architecture, I spoke with architect Chris Dyson and writer Dominic Bradbury about his recent book, Chris Dyson Architects, Heritage and Modernity, published by Lund Humphreys in September this year.
A is for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of A is for Architecture. I'm talking today to Chris Dyson and Dominic Bradbury about their recent book, Chris Dyson Architects, Heritage and Modernity, published by Lund Humphreys. It was published this year or last year?
This year.
Very recently.
Last Friday, yeah.
Last Friday. Okay, so it's fresh off the press. Thank you ever so much for joining me. It was a really good read, really interesting. And I've obviously known about Chris Dyson Architects, your work, for a long time. But perhaps we can start with some self-introductions, which are always slightly awkward. Chris, would you start? Would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I am Chris Dyson. I lived and worked in Spitalfields, London. I studied at Oxford Brookes and then Glasgow School of Architecture at the MAC. And then I worked for James Stirling and Michael Wilford for many years, 12 years. And then I worked for a brief period for 3 years before deciding to set up my own practice with Terry Farrell. I set the practice up 19 years ago, and I very much think it's kind of born out of Spitalfields, where I've lived and worked with my family for 33 years or 32 years now. I think it's very much shaped some of the work that we've done. I have enthusiasm, shall we say, for sketching, drawing, photography, and architecture is a huge passion of mine. And I also like cycling to try and remove myself from the daily chores of running a practice so that I don't get too anxious.
And, how do you get out of central London on a bicycle?
Usually on a train. So on last Saturday I was cycling Historic Churches of Suffolk ride, which Dominic will know because he's not far away, and that you pick off various churches. I think there's over 300 churches in Suffolk. It was the most wealthy county at one time, or one of them, for the wool trade back in 16th century. And so what I do with a friend who's Andrew Schoons from the engineering club is we cycle from one church to the other. And so this Saturday, as you're probably aware, it was a bit of a heat wave down here, and it was quite welcome relief to go inside cool, thick walled churches and explore the interiors a little longer than we might normally do.
Yeah. You didn't get stuck in the Tour of Britain. That was going through Suffolk, wasn't it?
Yes, I understand. No, we didn't. No, no. So, I wouldn't have kept up anyway.
Maybe we can get to the relationship between you and Dominic and this co-written book, I suppose we can come to. But Dominic, maybe if you want to introduce yourself, because you're not an architect.
I'm not. No, I'm a writer and journalist, and I've been writing about architecture and design and interiors for, I guess, something like 25 years, past 25 years. And a lot of my work was initially sort of journalism for various newspapers and magazines. And then it's increasingly become more book related. So I work with a number of different publishers, including Thames and Hudson and Fiden and Lund Humphreys, who published this monograph. And so I think I first became aware of Chris's work through writing a number of articles for magazines and so on about projects that Chris has designed in the past, including his own house in Spitalfields, but also a number of other projects in Spitalfields. And so, I've admired Chris's work for a long time. And having done a number of monographs before with Lund Humphreys, including a monograph on the architect James Gorst and Nick Eldridge also. So we have done a number of projects together, Lund Humphreys and I. And so eventually I suggested to them that perhaps we should look at doing a book on Chris's work. And it seemed to be a good time to think about that, because as Chris said, I think it's about 20 years of work now at the practice. So we began a relationship, kind of three-way relationship between Lund Humphreys, myself and Chris, that led to the sort of creation of this book. And actually a lot of the meetings we had talking about Suffolk, a lot of the meetings we had were held in at Chris's house in Suffolk, which is in beautiful village, but also very quiet. So we could sort of concentrate on our conversations together. And I'm based in Norfolk, so it was actually, you know, a kind of pleasure to drive down sort of through the country roads to Chris's place and meet there. But also I do know Spitalfields quite well, because that's so obviously where the train always sort of takes you in from Norfolk to Liverpool Street. And when I'm in London, I'll often stay in Spitalfield. So I find myself walking past sort of Chris's projects sort of all the time when I'm in London. And it's just this little sort of game you can play by of sort of walking around Spitalfields. Not that Chris only works in Spitalfields, but you can walk around Spitalfields and try and spot a Chris project.
Maybe we could start, because I sent just this morning, I sent some obviously some prompts through, which didn't really give you time to overthink it, which was kind of the purpose, because kind of worry a little bit that some people get a little bit they plan it too much, and that's not the joy of a podcast. But maybe we can start with this idea of London, which is very an interesting one. So Spitalfields, obviously, you live on Fournier Street or one of those Huguenot houses?
Well, we used to live, we've moved around. Ambrose, we started on Fournier Street, number 11 and a half, which got included on the Olympic countdown of 2012, in between 11 and 12. But we started there in a fire damaged wreck, which I bought. And then we moved around the corner as the family grew, and to Princelet Street, which is just one street parallel in the same sort of Georgian block. Then finally we moved to where we are, which is across the street. So we've never really moved with a removal van. We've always carried little boxes across the street. And as children got older, they got more able to carry heavier things, of course, which is more useful.
But it's a kind of perfect spot, isn't it? I mean, that whole set of Huguenot housing, which is exquisite, obviously. And I think it was it in Down and Out in London and Paris, Orwell's book, or was it in Jack London's People of the Abyss? They spend time in one of those houses, and it's absolutely rammed full of day labourers at that time, at the time that they're writing. Early 20th century, I presume. But you're right there on the edge of the city of London, the richest place in the world. Or at least it was, and is not far off still, and which is hyper modern. And I wonder to what extent you feel that context, to come back to the theme of the book of heritage and modernity, has perhaps been instrumental in the way that you've approached these things.
Yeah, I think my approach to some, like for example, the first project I did, which is 1 Fournier Street. Where we had Timberland as a client, quite an unusual kind of commercial client, who wanted to take over the building on a long lease, has to be said. But that involved restoration of the project. I was concurrently working on a project which we'd won, which had set me up with Michael Wilford, for a museum in Africa, which is a thoroughly modern cultural building project, which was all about planning a cultural village as an asset inside the Speer Estate in Cape Town, and on what was called the Verve locally, which is kind of like where the the main estate houses, and then it extended up through the scrubland between the winery, the vineyard, and the verb. And so I was doing this on the one hand, and I was given the project to by a very generous neighbor to work on this restoration of number one Fournier Street. And in so doing, I was kind of picking up the skills of or the awareness of the crafts involved in the project of a Georgian building. And so the master carpenter who was responsible for realizing the paneling of the rooms, the electrician, the plumber, of course, which is an important aspect of any project, the plasterer, who works with lime plaster, so that the basement was limed and not dry lined and not tanked. It was limed, and the basement floor was a limecrete. And so I started to learn all of these techniques, or learn about all of these crafts, which are actually important for the preservation of what is Spitalfields is unique. And it has, I think, over 30 listed buildings in what are three streets or something, maybe even more. And they're only grade two listed, but even as such, they are distinctly different on their interiors. They should be grade two star, to be honest, but which means that they would be the interiors would be listed and protected, because they are all quite different. They look very similar from the exterior, but they're very different on the inside. They have over time had changes. And I think that was something that I'm aware of, is that over time, those layers, those palimpsests of history become really interesting, and we are just working through another layer of history, and that's all we're doing. We're doing the best we can as a practice, and in terms of restoring and repairing and bringing these houses back into new use, so they do have kitchens, they do have bathrooms, whereas they didn't perhaps have these things in such overt ways before. Obviously, you could wash yourself and all of that, and you could cook in those buildings, but it wasn't quite so overt as it is now, and it needs to be for modern living. You do have electric lighting, you don't have a candle, or you don't have gas light. You know, all of these things need to be integrated, but in a sensitive way. And it was I felt it was my responsibility as an architect working with a background that I come from modernist background, working at Macintosh in Glasgow, and then coming to work for Stirling and Farrell, and then stepping into this environment. I felt that, you know, with the right sensitivity and the understanding of history, one could actually make a very valid and valuable contribution to the layering and the history of these houses without destroying their character, by actually enhancing and maintaining their character.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that's a bit of a long-winded answer, but that, you know, I think that's the responsibility one has if you're an architect taking on things. You mustn't. I think you have to understand what's valuable in the house and what's of value, and that's something that you have in intrinsically from your training or from your understanding that you apply to your work.
It is an extraordinary part of London in which to sort of live and work, isn't it? I mean, there's so many different sort of influences coming together. And you know, as you said before, Ambrose, you know, you've got the city sort of right on the edge. You've got sort of Spitalfields Market. You have the Huguenot sort of terraces, and then you have Brick Lane, and then Shoreditch, you know, everything that's happening in Shoreditch on the edge, or Hackney, and all of these sort of different layers coming together, and all these different influences, and then the sort of the whole art world sort of context of as well, I'm sure Chris will talk about, which is another important theme in the book. But you know, this is also home to sort of artists, and you know, it's artist studios, and you know, Gilbert and George's new museum is just up the street and round the corner, isn't it, Chris?
In Heniard Street, next to what was McCormack Jameson Pritchard's office and the Pride of Spitalfields. They've obviously been an intrinsic part of the area quite a bit before I, but they and the many MJP, other artists.
MJP or Gilbert and George?
Well, both of them, actually. MJP have contributed historically into sort of little master plans for studies for Tower Hamlets and the local councillors over time, but that is almost getting lost in the annals of history now. But for example, there is a current competition or a project out for the master plan of Brick Lane, which I've just understood is out, and I think they should be looking at MJP's early schemes and drawings, because I think the same principles still apply. And those, you know, if anybody ends up listening to this and thinks, where can I find that? They're in the AJ, somewhere in the annals of the 1970s, I think. However, the issues haven't changed. And it is about East meets West, and, you know, this whole idea of the city and its affluence and the East and its relative poverty, if I'm honest, over time, and still is apparent, very much apparent. And we work together as a local community, often on different things. But, you know, I think we managed to gel as a community, cheek by jowl, as through various different communal activities, and we have street parties and things like that. We have you know, other important intrinsic events, which are, or not just necessary events, but things of social value, which we all take part in.
That's interesting. I'd love to come back to that idea of the kind of the urban social role of the type of work that you do, but maybe we can go to Dominic first and just ask about this kind of relationship. So you're a journalist, you're a writer, and the books that you've mentioned, obviously they have a more of a historical, you're looking back at practices and architects that have operated, but now in this book you're looking at a live thing, which is quite an interesting idea, a kind of live historiography, a live kind of unpacking of the emergence of a practice, but also situating it within a longer historical story. I wonder if how did you see your role as the writer of this book, or as a principal writer of this book, as how does one go about doing that? I mean, without obviously saying anything that's going to upset Chris. No,
I mean, I never want to upset Chris.
Go for it, Dominic. Don't worry.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I've written about architectural history quite extensively. So, you know, what I've done a number of books on architecture of the 50s and 60s, so the post-war period, which is one of my sort of favourite periods of architectural design. And most of my work has been sort of focused on 20th and 21st century architecture. So I think there is an interesting sort of perspective there. And I think with these monographs, I mean, as I say, I've done a sort of number of monographs on contemporary architects as well as, you know, historical subjects. Mm-hmm. And I think it's in a way, I think, but rather like Chris's book, you know, you're sort of trying to contextualize the work, but you're also trying to document the work. And I think all of the monographs that I mentioned, the James Gorse monograph, the Nick Eldridge monograph, they're probably all around that kind of 20-25 year point, which is quite mm-hmm. interesting. So in other words, there was a substantial body of work that had been built up over that period of time, and there was an opportunity to sort of, you know, cast our eyes back over that work and sort of revisit some of that work, and then not only attempt to document it, but to sort of explore some of the themes around that work. And so with Chris's work, for example, I think it was, you know, many of the early conversations we were having were about the themes that have sort of influenced Chris's work, as well as his own history, you know, with Stirling, Wilford, you know, his time up at Glasgow, his connections with, you know, artists over a long period of time, his collaborations with artists over a long period of time that sort of have continued, running his own art gallery for a period of time, and then sort of trying to pick out what the sort of common threads might be within those projects, bearing in mind we're not just talking about Spitalfields and the context of Spitalfields, because Chris has worked in a number of other settings. So, you know, in Crystal Palace at the Park, for instance, where he has designed a project, or he's now working in Harrow. So it's not purely focused on Spitalfields, but I think Spitalfields is kind of the foundation, the sort of heart of it. And I think a number of the key themes can be seen in the work in Spitalfield, and particularly the relationship, you know, as the book says, the book is called, you know, Heritage and Modernity. And I think it's actually a really interesting relationship to talk about, and the way Chris has developed this sort of unique dialogue between the past and the present, which is, I think, a very sophisticated and sort of interesting conversation, a very interesting sort of dialogue, and layered in itself. You know, it has many different sort of layers to it. But I think for me, I mean, I suppose it's sort of two things. This sort of the Jane Jacobs kind of idea of the, you know, the necessary diversity of cities and neighborhoods within cities, with the kind of the mixture of buildings and, you know, typologies and histories, and styles and aesthetics that you need to bring a neighborhood to life. And I think Spitalfields is probably one of the best examples in London of that happening sort of all around you, and then I think the whole sort of conservation question is really interesting in relation to Chris's work, because I think he has brought life back to so many, you know, fascinating and important buildings.
Yeah.
But even when it's a new building, as in Crystal Palace, there is a very strong contextual element to that work, as I'm sure Chris will talk about. So there is a research process that has gone into the project at an early stage that looks at the history, the setting, you know, the vernacular, perhaps, you know, in the case of Crystal Palace, the history of the park, and so on and so on. And all of these layers, all of these different sort of layers of information are then sort of brought into the project. And then the result, I think, as we've said in the book, is are projects that feel as though they belong to that place. So even if it's a new project like Crystal Palace, or an old project like, you know, some of Chris's work in Spitalfields, it has a very special sense of belonging. And I think that's something we talked about a number of times within our conversations that sort of fed into the book. So just to talk very briefly, I mean, the foundation of the book was really the Suffolk conversation. So our meetings that we would have, always very enjoyable meetings that we would have in Chris's dining room in his house in Suffolk. And so we began by talking about background and history. So Chris's own background and his own history, and the influences, the sort of Stirling years, sort of Wilford and so on. And then we began to sort of move on to individual projects, sort of case study projects that we selected together. So in that, the structural planning of the book was very collaborative, which it always is. And the resulting book, I should say, is very much a bespoke book.
I mean, it's really interesting. I'm kind of want to come to this title of the book, Heritage and Modernity, and you call it, at a later point, conservation and reinvention, which I think is quite an interesting set of tensions, because obviously when we think about modernism, high modernism, we think about the erasure of stuff. And you were talking before we were recording, Dominic, about a book, your doctoral research looking at Seyfertz and Dennis Lasdon. And obviously that whole high modernist and brutalist and mid-century modernism was quite erasure-based. And I wanted to ask, was the title of the book in your mind already, or was it something that you sort of discerned through the process of writing the book, that these were the key themes, and that the work of Chris was worthy of writing, but you sort of weren't sure why and what you would discover through it, and then through this process of writing, you hit upon these themes. That was sort of the first question. Then I also wanted to know, Chris, about your background in Glasgow, which you must have been studying in what, in the 80s?
Yes, the late 80s. Yes, I started at work. Yeah, I'm 57 years old. So I think it was it was in the late 80s, and Andy and McMillan and Izzy Metzstein were the professors at the time, very much engaged in teaching the school and leading it, and all of their ex-Gillespie Kidd and Coyer staff seemed to be employed mostly as tutors in the school at the time. I think that was an amazing period of time in the history of the school, another layer of history in that school, which actually I did my thesis in Istanbul, Topkapi Palace, a world university, and it does get mentioned in the beginning of the book, because I think that's an important thread to my interests in history and the way that one can build a new building within a historical context. And even back then, I was kind of keen to do it right in the heart of one of the most historic cities in the world in terms of layering, obviously, where east meets west across the sea. And Topkapi Palace was the palace designed largely by Sinan and others. It was an amazing structure which had been adapted, as I say, by lots of layers of history, and making courtyards and subsequent dynasties changed it. And the idea of the World University was that it is a building which could unite tensions, which back then was obvious as well, through a lot of the media and things, that there were a lot of tensions between East and Western cultures, and as there always have been. And the idea that education, a university facility at that point, could be a powerful influence on people and perhaps change people's attitudes and lead to less warfare and all the rest of it, was the ambition and aim of the project, the thesis of the project. So it had a library, it had a debating chamber, it had accommodation, it had all the usual facilities that a university might have, but it was very much its location at that point which drove its position. And I think that approach to building new within a historic context still applies in our project, for example, which we isn't in the book but is mentioned, is at Fashion Street. We're just building out right now a new office building right in the heart of the conservation area, which is a little palazzo style building, modern brick and stone. When I say palazzo, it's kind of formal elevation is a grid of three windows at base and six, and the brickwork arches get wider and wider as you go up the building, a bit like Kahn's building at Exeter Library, so that there's this kind of inevitability about the design. It's sort of like it unfolds, and it looks right because it's chosen with the right materials and fits in its context. And I think those learning from proportion of street elevations in the area over time, one that has begun to inform an approach as to how one might build new buildings in that area as well. So they're not just glass, faceless glass solutions, which is so common, and you find that in the city. That seems to be the solution, is to make a shape and then clad it in glass, and it all becomes about the cleverness of that cladding and the articulation of that cladding.
Yeah, but I wanted to come to this. So obviously at the Mac, you've got Izzy Mertzstein, and you've got the Gillespie Kitten Choir, late Gillespie Kitten Choir, brutalism, international style, modernism. But you also have at the same time, you know, Mark Baines, you mentioned, of Happy Memory, who's the sets up the Heritage Association for Greek Thompson. So you have, and at that time in Glasgow, you've got that postmodern turn where tenement renewal is going on, urban renewal is going on, and they're reusing and reutilizing historical forms, not least the tenement itself, but also the languages, the visual and aesthetic languages going on. That must have played some kind of critical role in the way that you approach things, that kind of need in Glasgow to infill rather than just decimate under, you know, like under the original post-war planning under Robert Bruce. I think is really, really, really interesting that this idea of, it's almost like architectural dentistry where you're kind of putting back small things and it will produce better social life than a kind of erasure kind of approach.
I couldn't agree more. I think as you put it, articulated it really well, Amber. I hadn't really kind of, gone that far back into it. I think that's absolutely right. I think the teaching, Mark was very strong as our year teacher in the fourth year, particularly, and his approach to telling us the story of not only his work, but others who interested him in the school and the life of the school, the daily life of the studio, which I attended regularly. I felt very important to be there physically, and I enjoyed that process. Mm-hmm. It is true that in Glasgow in that time it was miles better, as they said, but yeah. It was a bit cheesy that, but anyway, that you know, the infill approach to architecture rather than the erasure of old tenements had quickly taken hold by then, and I think it became clear that one shouldn't remove these amazing stone buildings. One should repair and restore them, and in fact learn from them, so that one was create new tenement buildings, be they brick, you know, because that was more affordable, that the one created this you know, amazing social model of tenement, which is like four or five or more apartments off a single staircase, which meant that there was a social responsibility and connectivity between those people who lived on that same staircase, which then extends out to the whole of society and community of the area, because there are different closes, different, you know, different streets. And it's a phenomenal Roman model, isn't it? Tenement model. And I think it still applies in some of the best mansion blocks here in the UK, in London, for example. You have mansion blocks which are eight stories high, which are quite dense and very dense models for housing. And I think they really offer some of the best opportunities for redeveloping London at a dense level in a modern way. Yeah.
The Dominic, perhaps you can talk sort of from the position of the disinterested outside observer, but I'm very interested in this historical reuse that Chris talked about at the very beginning, which is a difficult thing to do, because I think a lot of people might think that that would involve sort of paint jobs and interior decor. But it goes beyond and deeper than that, to think about the value of heritage, the value of existing buildings for the contemporary, for contemporary lifestyles, for contemporary ways of doing things and businesses and the ways we work now. It's very complicated. I mean, what has been your kind of approach to thinking about that in Chris Dyson's work?
Well, I think that in some ways that's what got me interested in Chris's work in the beginning, because I'd sort of done a number of articles about the Spitalfields houses, including Chris's own house. And I think what's one of the things that's unusual about Chris's work as an architect, I think, is the way his work then carries over into the interiors, you know, into restoration, working with artisans and craftspeople, and the attention to detail that sort of carries over every aspect of the project. So it's not only the architectural form, which might include additions, extensions, or some quite radical interventions at times, but that then carries through all the way through to the choice of paint colours, which is something we talked about a number of times. But that those choices again are sort of informed by, you know, context, history, and many other things, as well as the way those colours might work together in a building. So you end up with this, all of these layers coming together in a very cohesive way, you know, in this sort of almost total work of art. So it's, I found that very interesting, because I think with many architects, well, perhaps a bit unfair, with some architects, you know, there's a point where they seem to stop and sort of go no further, you know, that they might hand over to an interior designer, or they will collaborate with an interior designer. I mean, Chris's practice will occasionally do that, but doesn't need to do that, because, you know, Chris is and his team are experts at all of those different layers. So it's, mm-hmm. it's architecture, interiors, and so on, gardens, landscaping. So I think that's another interesting aspect of that makes these projects very cohesive. And so if you look at Crystal Park, the Park Cafe that we were talking about before, mm-hmm. obviously the sort of the landscaping is very important there, the setting of the park itself, the way that was informed, obviously, by the sort of, you know, the way the park was laid out during the sort of Paxton era. Mm-hmm. And you know, various references that Chris had sort of picked up on that were to do with the landscape and the setting and the way those paths were sort of laid out across the park and so on, the way the boating lake is sort of situated sort of next to the park, and so you have this sort of rise up the bank towards the boating lakes that the building was responding to. So you know, landscape is also very important. I find it fascinating, you know, how Chris and his practice managed to bring all of these elements together and use them as sort of sounding boards and sort of points of inspiration.
I think that is a good example, that project, in terms of new in a historic context as well, because obviously the park itself being laid out by Paxton in the 1820s, you know, it was for the Great Exhibition, it was an amazing thing, and so we had to respond to that main axis running through north south through the park, and ours is off to the west, but towards the lake. But it also, by the lake, you've got the dinosaurs, which are a little bit like cartoons of dinosaurs to us now, but the Victorians, you know, it was very much bringing to life in physical form these ancient historic animals. And so they use something called code stone as their finish, which is sort of wrapped around and quite a crude structure of metal and brick and all sorts of rubbish. And so they were being restored as part of the overall project of restoration in the park. And our project was one of those aspects, and we were teamed up with Lynn Kinnear, who's a very talented landscape architect, who chose us to because of our work in historic settings, and knew, I think, instinctively we would come up with an appropriate solution that she could work alongside as a landscape designer, to realize the project. And that's really what drove it. You know, very early on, this idea of linking a bridge across from the lakeside walk into the building at the first floor, and then going down into the cafe, or staying on that level to enjoy the higher level view and perhaps a slightly quieter dining, or even take part in a yoga or a dance. You know, it's a community facility on that first floor. So, and there was a lift in the building, so it made it easier for people with wheelchairs to access the side of the lake than going up quite a steep ramp in the landscape of the park. So the building works quite hard for a relatively modest spend. The cladding of the building in that case responded to the scales of the dinosaur in a sort of very overt way. Cedar shingles are half rounds. And people bought that quite an early stage of the project. So it was very important that it was kept and maintained. So often these things can get lost. But we didn't have to fight too hard to keep that. It was an essential character of the building.
I quite like this idea because it's not pious, and I find there are certain architects who work in kind of historic contexts who address it by being incredibly, the word pious I think is a good one. It's kind of po-faced and or they try and step back, but this isn't trying to do that, and it comes to this. It's an interesting, perhaps it comes back to this idea of adapting for reuse in a way that understands the inherent character of the context that you're working in, the building or the park, in the case of the Crystal Palace Cafe. I'm kind of interested in this idea of authenticity. So what does it mean to be authentic in relation to historic fabric? Because I think perhaps people might assume that means replicating that which came before, just doing it again, but with cavity walls rather than solid walls, and probably a bit cheaper looking, but you're not doing that at all, and yet you're it's still authentic.
There's certain qualities such perhaps traditional. There's a pitched roof. There's a fireplace with a chimney. There's a bridge. All of these elements are elements of architecture that go back a very long way, but they're built unashamedly in a materials that we felt were appropriate and we thought reflected their time. And we don't actually consciously say, oh, we've got to build this out of stainless steel because it's a 21st century material or 20th century material. We just felt that it felt right. It was an appropriate thing to do. I mean, there's a lovely example of another building in the park, which I really admire in Richie's, they call it the Rusty Laptop. It's a bit derogatory. It's a lovely thing. It's a stage surrounded by a lake. And Ian came up with that for the millennium for 2000. And, several concerts have taken place there. And I think they're trying to revive it now again, because it's had a little bit of disrepair. But it is intrinsically a modern thing, built of Core 10, which is another material I quite like using on projects, which instantly weathered and felt appropriate in its setting. Mm-hmm. And that for me was one of those things I said, right, we should follow that lead in a way. When we did our analysis of the park, we should find something which has its own voice, it represents its own time, is not necessarily going to look like Victorian architecture from Paxton's era. Mm-hmm. We did get some pressure from one or two people, vocal friends of the park, who wanted us to rebuild a section of Paxton's cast iron arches, which would have been very worthy and noble to as an exercise, but a little bit irrelevant to the brief. And would probably have cost us fortunes if we'd gone down that hole, but we didn't. We resisted it, and we just found something which is appropriate for the brief.
I think it's a really good example, that project of Chris's work in general, in the sense that I think it's really respectful to the setting. It's really sensitive to the setting. It's very intelligent. All the homework has been done, all the research has been done, and Chris talked about some of the influences that have played into that building. But it's also has this playful, communal quality. It's a sort of much loved, much used building that people really enjoy and sort of respond to. So it's used by a lot of families, used by sort of cyclists as a stop off point. There's a lot of fun things sort of going on in that building. So when you're talking about the work not being pious, I think that's a really good, that building is a really good example of that.
It's loved by dog walkers as well, isn't it? It was funny during lockdown. It had just been finished by then, and lockdown, it became this salvation for a lot of people because they could serve coffee and teas and whatever through a window, and people could enjoy the sunshine terrace, and because the terrace faces nicely in the right direction, and there's a lovely tree that Lynn had insisted was planted there, and you know, that it became this place in the park where people could actually still get together but safely and enjoy that setting.
And interestingly, you can see it in another way as well, because if you look at the pictures of the project, you know, even though Crystal Palace is obviously a sort of very urban, sort of built-up environment, the park itself has this quite sort of almost bucolic quality. And you know, in the pictures, you sort of see the buildings surrounded by trees and, you know, parkland itself. And there's almost this sort of, you know, another layer to it, which is this almost sort of vernacular layer of a sort of, you know, a barn or an agricultural building in a sort of in the landscape, which is, you know, adds this other sort of dimension to it.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I have to say, it was a lot of our projects, I have to acknowledge, I mean, it's my name that's on the top of the tin, so to speak, but it is a lot of people involved in these projects, and the team at my practice, you know, have been with me for quite a long time now, and I couldn't do these things without them. They it is a very much a team effort on many of these projects, and yeah, that's something that's important to acknowledge.
Yeah, of course you've got to put your sleeve notes in, you've got to thank everybody. It's I understand. No, but it is this idea of architecture as a polyphony, really, isn't it? It's not I think when I first started thinking about studying architecture, I had wildly inaccurate ideas of what it was. And it was that moment where you go into, I think it's your part 1 year in practice, actually, where you're like, oh, right, I am. because all the way through undergraduate teaching, you're still designing these standalone things. And I think this issue around, so the Crystal Palace building is very interesting because it's an open space. And so you have to kind of, you seem to have excavated in a way that it's sort of an archaeological process of trying to understand what the site and space is about as a piece of London, as a piece of South London, but also it's, you know, talking about the dinosaurs and Paxton and then the way that you interact with the landscape architect. But in domestic settings, that's perhaps even more complicated, particularly when you're adapting historic spaces, without falling into this trap of simply giving it a lick of paint and trying to make it look Georgian again, because we're not Georgian, so it's not necessary now. And then to go back to this idea of the urban context is like, what are the buildings doing urbanistically, which allows them both to kind of replicate their be authentic to their heritage, but at the same time become part of a new urban realm, which I think, again, going back to Spitalfields, is particularly pertinent there, where the big glass towers are slowly creeping down the roads towards you.
No, well, as you were talking there, I was thinking, you know, what are the interventions in some of the major interventions we've done, like Maison Colbert,
yes,
which is mentioned in the book, but not that widely published in it. You know, it's been a really big piece of work for a number of people in our practice for the last 6 or 7 years, and has been a fantastic learning curve for the younger members, the part ones and part twos have come through, to see how you could, you know, basically we were instructed by the town planners to keep the facade at the town planners, I meant Tower Hamlets, of the streetscape, because they felt it was an important cohesive whole in the block. And so we worked with that, and we then dug down and we went through the layers of London clay down 4 or 5 meters, and we came across Italian Romans, 13 or 14 of them, bodies who had been obviously laid by the wayside of Middlesex Street that led in as a historic line road that led into the City of London. And there again, you've got this layer of history that's suddenly unearthed, and you have to build this amazing, well, very sympathetic. The Museum of London come on site at the client's expense, and they spent almost 6 months raking, digging, brushing, collecting these bones, putting them in storage. and then allowing us to continue with the project. But that allowed us to build this amazing art gallery space, which, you know, talk about the conversation about collaborating with artists. Artists can be incredibly accommodating and creative about these things, and it can be a real joy rather than the commercial pressures of an office building development where one would be, oh, I've got to get this done. You know, the project manager's breathing down your neck to get this basement in so we can have, you know, 1,000 bicycles and get the piles in to build a 50-story tower on top. There wasn't that same pressure. And although the project probably took even longer than some of those projects, it was a beautiful sequence of work. And yes, we did in that case collaborate with Buchanan Studios in the end as an interior designer. But
yeah,
I think there is an example of living and working in an urban context in a creative way, and they continue to do so.
And I think it's also a good example, you know, coming back to this idea of sort of piety in architecture. I mean, I think, you know, as Chris said, there was whole layers of archaeology, the facade was kept and so on. But behind that facade, you now have a very distinctly sort of 21st century environment that combines, you know, the open volumes of the artist studios on the sort of lower levels, and then, you know, a wonderful living spaces on the upper levels of the house, and they feel like very contemporary spaces when you walk into them. And even though they are informed by the past, even though there is this dialogue, you know, with the past, they feel very contemporary, and some of the living spaces are very, you know, have these playful layers to them, which is, you know, partly due to conversations with the clients and so on. But, you know, there is a real character to those spaces that is, you know, almost a sort of a world away from the sort of pious, you know, that pious stereotype of the architect.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting project also, because it has to straddle this line between being both domestic and a public resource. You know, it's a gallery, isn't it? There's a tension line within it, which I think is quite a fascinating one.
Yeah, it is. And it's one I actually lived with myself in our own home. We mentioned our children earlier, Oliver and Isabella. They grew up in this house at number 11, or 24, and then number 11 Princess Street, where we lived and worked. And I, in the end, went for number 11 from having lived in 24 for a while. Went for it because we could build a studio at the back and we could have an art gallery in the meeting room at the front in this set of Georgian rooms. And it was that layering of the convenience of living and working, which actually, you know, has been a long tradition in the neighborhood. You know, Huguenots did it with their silk weaving. They wove on the top. They had silk weavers, and the master weaver would live with his family below. And the idea of the weavers at the top was to do with daylight, so they would get maximum daylight from sunrise to sunset, and allowing them to work without candlelight or any artificial light to get the colors and the threads in the right places to make some amazing garments, which still today you can see in the V&A collection. That closeness is still a requirement. Some creative working in the 21st century, not just as an architect, but in many ways, like as an artist or as a film writer. The area has attracted all sorts of other people from different disciplines who enjoy that relationship of the working and the living very close to hand to hand.
And I remember Chris saying, actually, when we were talking about his own house on Princeless Street, that, you know, the space at the top of the house, he's actually, you know, where the weaver's lofts might have once have been, you know, that sort of along the terrace. He's chosen that space for his kitchen and sort of dining area and a terrace. So, because obviously that's, as Chris will tell you, you know, one of the best parts of the best spaces in the house in terms of sort of light, the views and so on. So that's quite a contemporary sort of solution to say, actually, we're going to put the sort of kitchen and the dining area right at the top of the house, because that's the sort of best, one of the best aspects.
I asked in my question, my last question, I think, to finish, this idea of adaptive reuse has become sort of mainstreamed over the last few years, and obviously in relation to whole discussions around climate and ecology and the environment. That's a fairly easy, logical kind of connection. But I was wondering, you know, is there something about the method of working that you do in historic context that has broader application to other ways? Is there something about the way, so we've talked, I think, a bit about, you mentioned palimpsests and this idea of kind of discovering the heritage, the history of spaces. Is this only relevant to this particular form of architecture, you know, this architectural practice of adaptive reuse, or could it be used as a way of, I don't know, designing a new school? Or,
well, I think it could be used as a way of designing a new city. I mean, it's all about context and reading a place and reading a country, understanding a culture. I was fortunate to be talking to somebody recently last week about the idea of rebuilding Ukraine.
Mm.
I mean, imagine being asked as an architect to go and do that. You know, help rebuild a village or a city in Ukraine. I think you could take the same qualities, same understanding, reading of place and culture and people. It requires perhaps a whole body of experts, not just the individual architect, to help contribute to that. But first of all, to write that thesis, write that, if you like, heritage statement. But it's much more kind of complex than that. To feed into and come up with an architecture which relates intrinsically to that place. And it doesn't mean to say it shouldn't be modern either. It should be modern. It should accommodate everything that it needs to. But it can have character and form and color and life which relates to Ukrainian culture, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm using that as an example. But I think that, you know, one could also do that in a new town village, for example, if you were to build a new town. And you could actually say, well, look, these are the elements of a village. That it needs a village green, it needs a pub, it needs a school, it needs all of these essential elements an English village or a British village that brings life to a place. And then one would use the local stone, use the local materials, and all of those things then become natural choices. Because you don't have to travel far to get things. You don't have to, you know, and you use local labor. And I think where possible, that has to be the future for us. We're at a crossroads of rethinking how we build things. And I think we should take advantage of it and actually use it, harness it architecturally. It's a bit like AI, the debate about AI. The one should not get, you know, we should be concerned about it. We should think about it. We should be in control of it. We are the architect is the master of all trades, but king of none. And that is our role. We have to be like this person who kind of orchestrates many different, spins lots of different plates. And those plates can be 4 or 5, or they could be 20. And that's the skill of the architect to be able to deal with that.
And I think that many of the principles that, you know, Chris has applied to sort of Huguenot buildings or period buildings, you know, could be applied, you know, to my mind, to postmodern, post-war buildings, so buildings of the 50s and 60s. So, you know, modernist buildings by people like sort of Lasdon, Seifert and so on, because we're now talking about the adaptive reuse of that period of architectural history, and how those buildings should be treated, and rather than talking about, you know, an architecture of erasure and just sort of tearing those buildings down to replace them. What can be done with the, you know, the buildings of the sort of 50s, 60s and 70s to sort of repurpose them, to give them fresh relevance, to give them sort of fresh life? So, I mean, be fascinated to sort of Chris and his practice sort of working on a, you know, brutalist building, or a 60s tower block, Lasden style cluster block or something like that, and seeing what the approach would be there.
For sure. Well, that's a great point to finish on. Thank you so very much, Chris and Dominic. I really enjoyed speaking to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambrose. Thank you.
The rest is silence. Well, nearly. Thanks to Chris and Dominic for the conversation, to Lund Humphreys for the book. Links to it and to Dominic and Chris's professional and practice profiles are in the podcast description. And thanks for listening.